At Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care. And we're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI? It's possible. Because we're already doing it. All while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Ireland has been on quite a roll for the last decade and more. After ages as one of Europe's poorest countries, it has exploded economically to become one of the EU's richest. When The Economist magazine looked around the globe late last year, it declared Ireland the country with the best quality of life in the world. This is not the country many Irish Americans' ancestors fled to escape starvation. This Ireland is a player in Europe and beyond. There are old problems. Northern Ireland remains an unresolved flashpoint, and now Ireland is dealing not with an outflow of emigrants, but an inflow of foreign immigrants. Tonight on Point, we look at this Ireland, the Celtic Tiger, with Irish Minister for Foreign Affairs, Dermot Ahern. Dermot Ahern joins me now in the studio. Ireland's Minister for Foreign Affairs is one of the highest profile government officials in Ireland and around the world. He's blunt spoken with a big view, and we are delighted to have him with us. Dermot Ahern, welcome to On Point.
Thank you very much. Thanks. Delighted to be here.
Wonderful to have you. I'm going to ask you straight off about the famous McCartney sisters and the sad story of their brother's killing. It's turned heads all across this country and been a kind of a window into a struggle going on in Northern Ireland that spills over into your domain. What do you make of this whole sad story?
Well, it is indeed a very sad story in that Robert McCartney was murdered, in effect, in a pub brawl. He was taken out and had his throat slit by people. But really what has brought it into focus is what happened after the murder, which was that the people that perpetrated it went back into the pub. They declared to the people inside the pub that it was an IRA job, and that if anyone gave any evidence or made statements about what had happened, they would answer to the IRA. They brought in people. They wouldn't let the people out of the pub until it was forensically cleaned. Mm. They even destroyed the CCTV cameras. So that made the local population rise up, in effect, and particularly the sisters and the partner of Robert McCartney.
This local population, of course, being the traditional kind of bedrock support population for the Catholic IRA there.
It would be a bedrock support for Sinn Féin, basically, in the community. It's a small community of about 3,000 people who are surrounded by mainly unionist, loyalist population in that part of Belfast. But it's ironic that, you know, historically the IRA would have portrayed themselves as the defenders of Catholics against the oppression of the British or the against loyalist gangs, and here they now are becoming the oppressors of the people, and the people are rising up because things have dramatically changed in the last 10 years. There's no rationale, if there ever was, for the IRA, but particularly in these geographic small areas, the only reason they hold sway now is for, to a certain extent, bully boy tactics, but also to show who are in charge of the particular area.
And this, of course, following the bank robbery, nearly $50 million worth equivalent. When President Bush stands in the White House then, this week, St. Patrick's Day, with the McCartney sisters, instead of the political leadership of Northern Ireland, what's on display there, Dermot Ahern? What's the symbolism?
Well, both I and our Prime Minister will be there on Thursday in the White House, and you're correct in saying that the McCartney sisters will be there also.
And not Gerry Adams of Sinn Féin, and not other Northern Ireland leaders who typically would be there.
I think the Bush administration have made a decision that, in view of the fact that the parties in the North failed to put together an agreement in the run-up to the end of last year, which we all hoped would happen, that it wasn't appropriate that they should be invited. So they're not being invited. We obviously are delighted to be there because we celebrate with your president the Irishness of America, and we're grateful for that. And it is true to say that this administration and previous administrations have been very significant in their influence on the peace process, in that the American influence has brought Iran much faster than perhaps it would have happened. But equally so now, the time, we believe, is it's very important for Irish America, but America generally, to send out a very strong signal that the Good Friday Agreement principles, which was voted on by on both sides of the border in 1998, which is the template for the future of relationships on the island, that it was inherent and built into that agreement that those parties that had links with paramilitarism would end those links forever and a day and would go into fully democratic politics in order to promote their political ideals and not have behind them an army or a threat of an army, the implicit threat of an army. So it's a key moment, and I believe that the message that is getting across from Irish America from the top down is, and speaking with Irish American politicians and representatives here in Boston, I did that in Washington and in New York last month, and I'll be there again in Washington later on this week. It's a very strong message, and it's important that it be given very on a united basis with the Irish government and with the British government.
Now, Sinn Féin, political wing of the IRA, one way of putting it, you have been very tough on them. In the Irish News, the newspaper, in February of this year, you said, "We would have nothing in the way of similar views in regard to social policies, economic policies, the whole basis upon which the democracy down here would be based." And you said, Dermot Ahern, Sinn Féin, want a 32-county socialist republic. Now, Sinn Féin is politically active on both sides of this border. What's brewing here? How does this get resolved?
Well, I mean, I'm a Democrat. I also regard myself as a Republican. My desire is to see my country unified, but I don't believe that shedding a drop of blood is worth Irish unity. I believe, as most Irish people do, that if we want to achieve our political aims, it's by democratic and peaceful means. And we can't have a situation where there are parties which have the vestiges of a paramilitary organisation behind them, who don't subscribe clearly to the ideals of democracy. So what we're saying clearly is that the peace process has been up and running since the Hume Adams talks 18 years ago when they started. Gerry Adams and John Hume sat down and agreed a process which has taken some time. 18 years on, we believe we're now at a crossroads in that it's up to Sinn Féin to decide once and for all, and the provisional movement, of which they're an integral part, that they're either going down the route of fully democratic and peaceful means, or else they're not. And if they're not, obviously, then we have to take stock of that. They can't have it both ways. They can't have, you know, moving towards a political scenario and at the same time having criminality and paramilitarism associated with them.
But what about the other side of that? You say, and always have, you're a Republican, that is, seek one nation, island-wide, one Irish republic. But what about the other side of the equation, the British and the Unionists in Northern Ireland? Can you see them ever really accepting that? And now that Ireland has done so well, has so much to lose, does that help move toward a Republican solution, or does that make it ultimately less likely? Because people are doing fine.
Well, the template for us living together in peace and harmony is in the Good Friday Agreement, which allows those people like me who desire a united Ireland. It allows us that aspiration and to work towards that. But equally so, built into that agreement is the principle of consent within Northern Ireland, that unless and until 50%, more than 50% of the population are in favour of united Ireland, it will not happen. That allows the unionist community to work in their own sphere, to work with us, but equally so it allows us to aspire to united Ireland and build on the North-South bodies which are built into the Good Friday Agreement. So that's the template for the future. So there should be no rationale for any other sort of military effort to force a united Ireland, because the scene has changed dramatically in Ireland on both sides. And you're absolutely correct. The Irish people are now extremely confident, both from a social point of view, an economic point of view, a cultural point of view. We can hold our heads high in the world. But what is holding us back is this constant, as you say, it's always in the news about the peace process. Mm. We have shown that we've gone from the poorest nation in the EU to the richest nation. We've gone from a situation where we're investing in the UK market, second only to America. We beat the Japanese and we beat the Germans and all the other major powers in gross terms, not in proportionate mm-hmm. terms. So we are now a very confident, economically confident nation.
And does all of that make the Republican vision ultimately more or less likely?
I believe it makes it more likely in that there was a time when Ian Paisley's of this world used to say, why would we unite with the Republic? They're a third world country.
Mm-hmm. Poor, backward, nothing but trouble.
And if you crossed the border into my constituency from the north, you could immediately see that the road infrastructure and all that was second rate in comparison with the north. That is not the case anymore. In fact, if anything, it's the opposite. We are just absolutely booming from an economic point of view. So we can move forward from a position of strength. And I mean, for instance, I have been a minister for the last 8 years in most of my spheres. We've endeavoured to have cross-border connections. For instance, in the area of energy, it makes absolutely no sense. And business people on both sides of the border, no matter what community they're from, can see the logic in not having two different electricity networks, mm-hmm. two separate ones mm-hmm. on an island of only five and a half million. Mm. So there now is much better communication and connection between the two electricity networks. So we're building on all those sort of issues where there is mutual benefit for the people. And ultimately, I think those people who are against the United Ireland will see that there's absolute benefits from all sorts of points of view for the people, their people, in having this better communication and connection between North and South.
So you believe they will come around. We're talking tonight with Ireland's Foreign Minister, Dermot Ahern, about the Celtic Tiger, everything it's accomplished, where it stands today, how Ireland sees the world. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight, and delighted to be so, with the Foreign Minister of Ireland, Dermot Ahern. He's in the United States this week, talking with Irish Americans and American officials right across the country. It's a privilege to have him in the studio with us tonight. Dermot Ahern, this buoyant, affluent, even wealthy Ireland now, with its unique view of the world, makes you a very interesting person for us to talk to on all kinds of levels. But let me ask you about how Ireland now looks at the United States and Europe. There's been a lot of talk in the U.S. about new Europe, old Europe, about whether Europe is, is got the vision of the future, or whether it's mired in a kind of self-interest and mired in the past, about two poles of power and influence. Here's Ireland. You've got a tradition of independence. You've done very well in the EU, but you've been deeply supported in all kinds of ways by the United States. How do you see the relationship between these two great communities, U.S. and Europe now, and Ireland's place in the middle?
Well, to a certain extent, we see ourselves as a bridge between those two big powers and our influence in the EU. We work as best we can to build on the transatlantic relationship between the U.S. and the EU. And we were absolutely delighted during our presidency to have a major summit with President Bush in Ireland during our presidency of the EU, which sowed the seeds for the most recent, very important visit by President Bush and Condoleezza Rice, which I attended in Brussels. And I can safely say that the relationship between the two blocs is now better than it ever was. It is a fact that the relationship was difficult and had up and downs in recent times, particularly. But I think now there's an acceptance that we have to work together, and to a certain extent, Europe have to get its act together and to portray itself as a united voice. I said yesterday at one of the functions I attended that in Harvard, actually, that I've heard it described as that we're different branches of the same tree. We hold the same ideals in relation to social justice, in relation to economic values, in relation to how we portray ourselves in the world.
That is the US and
US
Europe.
And Europe, yes.
But these two blocs, you're saying, with better relationships than ever? I mean, do you sincerely mean that, or after all the stress that we saw in the last half dozen, fewer years, I guess, all that seems to remain, you really think it's back on that good a plane?
Well, I think it is, because the success of the visit of President Bush and Condoleezza Rice, I think, is there to be seen. We're working very, very closely behind the scenes with the administration here in relation to the Middle East peace process, which is on our own back door, and we believe is at least one of the sources of the major conflict in that part of the region.
And when you say our back door here, you mean Europe. Ireland
Europe's,
is part of the EU.
Europe's back door, and equally so, we have a huge role to play in particularly an issue like Iran. We also are more than willing to help in relation to the Iraqi situation. So on a myriad of issues, we believe that the relationship can be built upon based on the recent meeting. Obviously, I'll be attending the White House with my Prime Minister on Thursday, and we will be continuing to give an Irish perspective in relation to these issues with the President and his team.
But we've seen these two very different faces of the United States and Europe. I mean, the United States, since the big sort of punch to the face it took on 9/11, bellicose, very willing to use its military, aggressive and unapologetic about it. Europe, on the other hand, you know, doing deals, going to the United Nations, saying settle down. They seem to project two very different visions of how the world ought to work.
Well, I think we do need, I mean, I think it is the case that we do need to work together to try and converge our views, because we do have, as I said, the same principles and ideals. It is the case, and particularly dealing with a Europe of 25 countries who are sovereign countries, we're not the same as the United States. Sometimes it's more difficult to get sort of a consensus in relation to issues. But the fact of the matter is, and we shouldn't lose sight of this, we have the same principles and ideals as the US. I do think that there is an acceptance now in Europe that we need to be, in effect, as much as we can, singing off the same hymn sheet with the United States of America in relation to troubled issues around the world. But one of the things that I think, and you mentioned the UN and particularly Ireland, who have a very good history of connection and involvement with the UN, and as a small nation, we look to the UN as the guarantor of human rights around the world, and also the interests of small nations who don't have the military power that perhaps the US and other blocs like China have.
But you know the UN's been bitterly disparaged by representatives of the Bush government.
I accept that, and I came over last month to meet with Kofi Annan, and I offered our help as a small neutral nation, but one that has perhaps punches above its weight internationally, that I have offered our help in the post-EU presidency situation to Kofi Annan and his team in order to drive the reform that is needed in order to ensure that, as your own President John F. Kennedy said, rather than a forum of invective, that the United Nations should be used as a way of portraying the ideals of normal democratic nations should be. So I'm glad you mentioned the UN, because it's one of the messages that I said yesterday in Harvard, and it's the message that the Irish ministers all over the world this week will be saying on St. Patrick's Day in different areas of the world.
Support the UN, reform the
absolutely,
UN.
Absolutely, because ultimately, and we have seen this in our own country, it used to be said that the British Army and the British establishment would defeat terrorism in Ireland. That hasn't happened. Why? Because you can't just militarily defeat terrorism. You have to look at the causes of terrorism.
You're saying message to Washington there.
It is a message to all countries, and you have to, and to be fair to the Bush administration in relation to what's happened in the Iraqi situation, and to a certain extent the UN and the US came from different standpoints in relation to the Iraqi situation, but we now have arrived at the one destination, which is democratic elections. And I think it's important that the UN and the US now work together in order to move that situation on from a positive point of view. And as you know, the UN are willing and want to, and so are the EU, engage in that scenario for the betterment of the people of Iraq in conjunction with the US administration.
Dermot Ahern, you're the Foreign Minister of Ireland. How do you see the idea of war on terrorism. Is that a construction that you support? And if so, what does it contain, ideally, in your view?
Well, again, I go back to the point that I make. You can't just defeat terrorism from a military point of view. You have to try and deal with the underlying factors. I mean, in Ireland, for instance, what made ordinary people take up arms or take Semtex and blow people up? I mean, there was something that caused ordinary people to do that. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, the negotiations that have taken place, and perhaps the Irish experience is a template for the Middle East and other troubled parts of this world. And indeed, we have offered again to the UN our resources that we have, small as they are, but the experience is just amazing that we've had in this area. If we are to be used, we want to be used, and we are willing to give our time to help in these troubled areas in a non-confrontational way.
So I
come back to the point. One person's terrorism might be different to another person's terrorism. I mean, when you look at what
are
is
you
going
saying
on,
one person's terrorism is another person's freedom fighter?
No, I'm making the point, I go back again, that, you know, we deal with situations in different parts of the world in different ways. If you look at what's happening in Africa, where the terrorism that people have meted out to them there is the terrorism of poverty, the terrorism of failed states, corrupt states, abusing the people. We have to deal with a myriad of issues, and the only way we can do that is on the basis of what they call multilateralism, not a unilateralism. And again, I say that it has to be done in such a way that not only do we fight terrorism in its basic form as in a military and security response, but we also have to look at the underlying reasons as to why that terrorism started in the first place.
Let's be a little more concrete then, if you would, Dermot O'Hearn, applying that perspective, Ireland's perspective, where people took up arms in anger, and you say there were reasons for it that had to be addressed. Apply that perspective to the Middle East, to Islamic fundamentalism, to Al-Qaeda. What should the world, what should Washington learn from this Irish perspective?
Well, I mean, Washington has been very central in what has happened in relation to the peace process in Ireland. And one of the things that clearly we see from the experience is that you have to negotiate and keep negotiating, even during difficult times.
With Osama bin Laden, with Saddam Hussein, with the mullahs who appear to be intractably opposed to...
Ultimately. I mean, obviously, you have to fight fire with fire if it happens. Of course you do. But ultimately, you have to also investigate ways of trying to get dialogue with reasonable people. And I think the Palestinian situation, the Israeli situation, shows that with some goodwill and some effort and honed-in effort, particularly effort in conjunction with the US and the EU, you can see already, particularly in the post-Arafat situation, that we now have an improving situation there with elections and with good movement there, and we would be very hopeful that would pan out well. I accept that there are certain circumstances where people will just not negotiate, like Osama bin Laden, and they have to be taken on, obviously.
Dermot O'Hearn, let's turn for a moment to Ireland's incredible economic growth and where that stands now. More countries coming into the EU, this time from the East, Eastern Europe. Ireland became very friendly to business a decade and a half ago, super friendly. All kinds of tax benefits, a super welcome mat laid down, and it worked. Is Ireland now at risk of being undercut by new EU members in Eastern Europe who have lower wages and perhaps even could put out even more friendly welcome mats for business at this point?
Well, we've been very welcome to the new member states. In fact, since the 1st of May when they joined, 60,000 people from those states, the 10 states, have actually come to Ireland and have got employment because we've a burgeoning labour supply issue. Which is a big change, as you say, from yesteryear. As regards our competitiveness, Ireland has become a high-wage, high-cost economy. There's no doubt about that. But we're also at the higher end of sort of the quality chain. And all research that we've done shows that we have to continue to invest in research and development and in training. And as a policy of government, we're doing that. We've been very successful in ensuring that a lot of research and development investment, both public and private, have gone into particularly Indigenous and American companies that are, have set up in Ireland. So it is always a challenge, but I think not only for the EU but also for America, the biggest challenge comes from places like China and India, and we have to be conscious of that. And again,
for Ireland as well, the challenge.
Oh, absolutely, yes. But I mean, again, we see huge benefit in the possibilities. I mean, it used to be the case that the American investment was huge in Ireland, but equally so, there's 70,000 people employed in America as we speak by Irish companies. And, you know, I'm staying in the Jury's Hotel here in Boston, and 120 jobs created by an Irish company. And we look forward to more of that because there are opportunities. As I said, we're one of the biggest investors in the UK, and we would like to see more investment from Ireland going into the US.
When you visit the United States and talk with Irish Americans, what's your sense of how up-to-date their sense of your country, their ancestral homeland, is today? How accurate or behind the curve are Irish Americans you speak with?
I think in Ireland we're under somewhat of a misapprehension that the Americans think we're still sort of sitting around the fire and doing Cayley dances and all that sort of stuff. I think Americans know right well that, and particularly those that have visited Ireland, that it's an incredibly changed place. There are people who came over to America, set up businesses here from Ireland, and have tried to go home. And in fact, when they've gone home to set up again back in Ireland, they've had some difficulties. They've found it a much different place. There are difficulties in Ireland, there's no doubt. I mean, there's very expensive housing. People would say it's got expensive, but equally so, you know, our wages are very good. Our taxes are, we came out in the OECD just this week as the third lowest tax regime from income and capital taxes in the world. So, you know, we have the spending power as a nation. Long may it last, and, you know, we're not complacent, I can assure you, in that respect.
And what about Northern Ireland and Irish Americans' impressions of what's going on there? Is the weight of the Irish American attitude toward that helpful in moving toward peace, in your view, or not, or even an obstruction?
I think it would be hugely effective if the message, as I think I said this earlier in the interview, that if the message from America was such to those people involved, particularly on the provisional movement side, that the time is now for decisions. We can't wait any longer for the what they call the Republican movement or the provisional movement to obey the will of the Irish people, which was voted for in the Good Friday Agreement almost universally on either side of the border.
You've said you can't have a situation where a party, presumably you mean Sinn Féin, is going to the electorate, quoting you, with a ballot box in one hand and an Armalite in the other. Do you think that's equally well understood among Irish Americans?
That wasn't a quote from me.
It was, but
I mean, it was a quote from one of the Sinn Féin people many years ago, Danny Morrison, who said that this was going to be their policy. And it's quite clear that the time has come for that type of policy to end. Either they're going to go fully for the ballot box, they cannot continue going for the ballot box and the Armalite in the other hand.
We know Ireland so richly and deeply as a source of immigrants to the United States. And as you were referring earlier, there are now plenty of people pouring into Ireland, coming to your economic miracle there, looking for jobs there. How's that going? The Ireland of the immigrants, of foreigners coming from elsewhere to settle in Ireland. How's it sitting with the Irish?
It's causing huge difficulties. I mean, we've gone from a situation where we were a single cultural society to now very much a multicultural society that has raised huge questions right across the country in geographic areas such as my own, where there's been a huge influx of people from Africa, from right across the world. It causes difficulties in that now in schools we've a myriad of languages where we used to have only one language. It's something I know the Americans have been used to for the two centuries.
It's something new in Ireland.
But it's completely new. We had an immigration service which was staffed only 8 years ago, maybe by 20 people. Today we've hundreds in it in order to cope with the level of net immigration into Ireland. But that's something that, you know, has happened most developing countries in the world in their history. And it's something that we have to deal with. And thankfully, we haven't had, we'll say, the racism in as much as we say other countries have had. Thankfully, it has been relatively muted. But that's not to say that, you know, there aren't issues in that respect. Of course there are. But generally speaking, it's a good experience for those people coming. As I said, 60,000 people from the new EU member states came in, and all of them apparently have got jobs and have assimilated into the country. And that, to a certain extent, has thrown off course all the predictions as to our population for the future, because our population, instead of what was forecast for around this period, it's actually rising rather than getting smaller.
Well, this is a new Ireland. Dermot Ahern, Foreign Minister of Ireland, it's been terrific talking with you. Thank you so much for joining us on Point.
Thank you.
Listeners, you can continue this conversation online. Go to onpointradio.org. After the break, Congress steps up its efforts to curb identity theft. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Identity theft seems to be epidemic these days. Our most personal information, from bank records and social security numbers to private phone lists and personal email, all appear terribly vulnerable. Just ask Bank of America, LexisNexis, even Paris Hilton. In the past few weeks, there has been a flurry of reports that data on more than 1.5 million Americans has been misplaced, hacked, or stolen. And that's just known lapses. Today, a House committee met to look at the growing problem of identity theft and possible solutions. Joining me now from Washington is Jonathan Krim. He's technology policy reporter for The Washington Post and was at today's hearing. Jonathan Krim, thanks for being with us tonight.
Tom, nice to be with you.
So how was the problem outlined today for this House committee? And what was the committee, by the way?
This was a House Energy and Commerce subcommittee that deals with privacy and other issues like that. They were fairly narrowly focused today on the two large data broker companies that have been in the news, ChoicePoint Incorporated and LexisNexis, as you mentioned in your intro. The data broker industry has really kind of creeped us up on us without a lot of attention to become these massive storage places of pretty much private records on every American adult. And what they do is they market these databases and analyses behind them to everything from law enforcement agencies to financial institutions and other companies that are doing everything from credit checks to employment screenings.
And what's the range of data in these databases? What kind of information, Jonathan?
It includes, as you said, driver's licenses, social security numbers, name, address. And then some of the databases have additional financial and credit information.
And, of course, the big problem is that it's often enough information for people to open credit lines, to get credit cards.
There are sort of two ways that identity fraud, if you will, happens. And one is that if you get a hold of a credit card number, for example, you can begin to just simply make purchases with that, even though it's not your card.
Mm-hmm.
The more difficult issue is when someone gets a Social Security number and then can essentially impersonate you by opening lines of credit. And then you have a very serious problem, because these issues get reflected in numerous databases, and it can take you years to sort of correct those.
We see Senator Charles Schumer saying recently, what bank robbery was to the Depression era, identity theft is to the information age. We're kind of in the wild, wild west here. What's the tone of the committee hearing on the House side today? Are they looking at regulating these data collectors?
They are. I think that's what has emerged from the early hearings on this issue, and there are going to be several more, is that it's clear that there will be regulation. And that's no small thing in this town right now, which has a very anti-regulatory bias. Today, what was interesting is that the chairman of the House committee, the full energy committee, Joe Barton of Texas, who's a very, very influential person now.
Texas Republican.
That's correct. he basically said that he is leaning very heavily toward legislation that would ban the commercial trading and sale of Social Security numbers without individual permission. That would put a pretty significant dent in some of what the data brokers do, and some privacy advocates would endorse that wholeheartedly.
That would sort of kill the industry, wouldn't it?
No, not really. There are plenty of other valuable pieces of personal data that are in these databases, and restricting the trading of Social Security numbers would not kill them. But what it would do is open up a bit of a Pandora's box where slowly the consumer would be able to assume more individual control over what would happen to their data. And that's something that I think the industry would fight pretty hard on. There was one congressman from Idaho today, Congressman Otter, who is a very conservative Republican, who even began to talk about personal data in terms of being a property right that the individual had at their disposal. And
fascinating, a new kind of information age property right, the
exactly.
very data about oneself.
That's right, and that would very much change the dynamic and the business model for these data brokers. I don't personally think that idea is going to go very far.
But we saw Massachusetts Democrat Ed Markey saying today, this is an industry still in denial, that still doesn't recognize how highly Americans value their privacy, that the industry, he's saying, hopes to ride out this scandal. Do you think there's a chance that nothing will change here?
I think there's a chance, and Congressman Markey, by the way, who is from your neck of the woods, was by far the greatest of the political theater givers today, and asked a number of very tough questions, rapid fire, raised his voice at several occasions. I think what is going to happen is that the industry will get very involved in the drafting of whatever legislation is coming down the pike. That is fairly standard operating procedure now here in Washington. And while they have agreed that some things need to change, I think they will probably be able to make sure that the changes are not drastic for their industry. And so I think what you will see, for example, is a national notification law like what California has, and which resulted in ChoicePoint having to inform all of their consumers who were breached that that had happened.
However belatedly.
And there was some reason for that, because the law enforcement agencies that were working on the case had wanted to keep the lid on for a while. But I think you will see a national notification law. The Federal Trade Commission is behind that and is also behind extending some of the security guidelines that financial institutions have for protecting their data, and extending those guidelines to the data broker industry, which is almost entirely unregulated right now.
Could you feel the heat of constituent anger and fear behind the congressman today? I mean, they may not want to tangle with this industry, but Americans seem justly fearful right now of being thrown into a kind of a hell of data theft.
No question. People are very concerned, and many of the Congress people today quoted from letters from their constituents. And I think the industry recognizes that they are not going to be able to simply put up a stone wall here and have nothing happen. I think, though, that what their strategy will be going forward is to ride out these hearings and then get involved in the grind-it-out legislative process, you know, that is the sausage-making that goes on in this town.
So watch this space to see what really emerges.
That's right. That's exactly right.
Jonathan, thank you very much for joining us tonight.
Quite welcome.
Jonathan Krim is a technology policy reporter for The Washington Post. He joined me from Washington for a closer look at the problem of identity theft. We turn now to Gail Hillebrand. She's senior attorney for the Consumers Union in San Francisco and has worked with U.S. senators to draft some of the legislation now being considered in Washington. Gail Hillebrand, thanks for joining us tonight. Hello, Gail, are you there?
Yes, I'm here. Can you hear me?
Terrific. Yes, thanks for being with us. Also joining us from New York is Terry Cullen, personal finance columnist for the Wall Street Journal Online. She's written about steps consumers can take to make their personal data more secure. Terry Cullen, thank you for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Terry, let me ask you first. We just heard Jonathan Krim describing what's going on in Washington, what's being considered there, a kind of a national notification law, so that when data is lost or stolen, consumers would be given a heads up. How do consumers tend to find out now if their personal data is lost, if they're a victim of identity theft?
You know, sadly, most people find out that they've become a victim when they're in a loan process. They're going to get their first mortgage or to take out a car loan, and suddenly they realize that their credit score is very low because there's been abuses taking place that they'd never known about. It's fairly rare that companies come forward. I think the law in California is really driving companies to be better corporate citizens and actually divulging when things are happening. But it's like pulling teeth to get these companies to come out and admit that their security has been breached.
And ChoicePoint, which is, of course, one of the very largest sellers of private consumer data, they did come out in February and say that there's many thousands of data files had been lost, but they had detected that in September. That's a long wait, isn't it?
Well, that wasn't even the first report of it. The first time that they had actually admitted that there had been a security breach, they said it had happened in October. And it wasn't until they went back and then a month later, or a few weeks later, I should say, they filed a report with the SEC that basically said, yeah, we actually discovered it a month earlier. So you're looking at about 5 months where this information has been out there, and consumers had no idea.
And, of course, you quote an official with the Identity Theft Resource Center saying that ChoicePoint, in spite of that, was the first data aggregator to come forth and disclose the theft of consumer information. We see in the Senate side on Capitol Hill today, Senate Banking Committee, that ChoicePoint, Vice President Don McGuffey said that the company had a handful, his words, of breaches even before this one, that it had simply not made public at all.
Right. This isn't the first time this has come up with the company, and consumers were never notified in the past. California residents have their laws to thank for the fact that most of the people across the country are now being told that these breaches have occurred.
Gail Hillebrand, who's got the bit in their teeth now on this issue, the federal government, Congress, or the states?
We need action and protection and prevention both from Congress and the states. From Congress, we do need a broad notice of breach law similar to the California law, but we also need preventative standards. We need standards for the security of these databases, for customer screening, because in the ChoicePoint instance and also in the LexisNexis instance, This was old-fashioned trickery, the fake customers who were essentially sold access to customers' data.
When you say customers, you mean people who came to these big data collection agencies and just asked to buy data from them?
They pretended to be legitimate buyers of data, and there's really not much to restrict who they can sell data to, and there is really no federal oversight of how they screen their customers or the kind of security that they have on the databases.
It's astounding when you think of all the damage that can be done and all the mayhem on people's personal financial lives that there aren't stricter standards somehow already.
It's like having someone else having the keys to your house and being allowed to sell them to other people.
So, again, where do you see momentum now, on the state side or federal side or both?
I think we'll see momentum in both places. In the state side, there are approximately 20 states now considering so-called security freeze laws. This gives the consumer the right to say, no one can look at my credit reporting file for purposes of granting new credit unless I unlock it.
Now, is that after a theft, or that's just generally? That's an umbrella freeze.
That would be an umbrella freeze. It's for prevention. And many state legislatures are looking at that right now. If you want to know if your state is among them, we have a list at financialprivacynow.org. On the federal side, we need to see Congress acting on these information brokers and asking the Federal Trade Commission or another federal agency to develop and really enforce security standards, customer screening standards, and the ability to see what they hold on you and to correct it if it's wrong.
Terry Cullen, do you have a sense of who's doing this identity theft? Is this large, organized crime? Is it individual hackers? What kind of organizations are behind it or people?
I think Gail had it right. It's really very low-tech. A lot of information that's being stolen is coming right out of your mailbox. People are taking it right out of the garbage. A lot of the information that comes through your mail has very sensitive information. Some of us, like myself, have a Social Security number that is used for various documents that you get that come into the home, like your health insurance policy or life insurance. And if you don't carefully dispose of them by shredding them and you just toss them in the garbage, that's identity thieves, smorgasbord right there. And also, again, with the ChoicePoint, as well as with the Bank of America thefts, Bank of America just simply lost data on more than a million of its customers.
Now, they said today that they hadn't found any ill effect from that as part of the testimony today. I guess we'll see.
We'll see. I think identity thieves have shown themselves to be very knowledgeable on how people work in response to finding out that their data has been stolen. I think there'll be an initial panic, and people will check the credit reports, and when they see no activity, they'll get complacent again. And those, and if the thieves had actually stole this and it's not nearly lost, then there's a chance that that data could be compromised later on.
Of course, this is I guess it was computer tapes on 1.2 million federal employees. As I recall, it was put on a flight and or supposed to be and didn't show up at the other end.
Right.
Gail Hillebrand, so the freeze is one thing, the security freeze, this national notification law, and there's the concept lofted today in the House of control of personal data being increasingly seen as a property right. Property rights in this country are very strong. If it would get that kind of armor on it, would that be a solution?
That would be an underlying way to address not just the symptoms but the real problem. And in the European Union, they take a much stronger approach to privacy, really requiring much more consent before your information that's collected for one purpose can be used for a different purpose. In addition, we need to both stop the sale of Social Security numbers and get them out of the envelope and out of the wallet.
But you know how life is. It seems to me that I'm always being asked for my Social Security number over the phone, you know, doing business here and there. Just in the last few months, I can recall writing it down a few times. I'm sure all Americans have this experience. It doesn't seem like a tightly encrypted number.
No, but there are things that can be done. The Medicare administration is still using the Social Security number on the Medicare card. That puts it in the wallets of a lot of elderly Americans where it doesn't need to be. Health insurers, many of them still use it as an identifier number. They could use a different number to identify you, reducing your identity theft risk.
And Terry Cullen, when it happens and the rubber meets the road, what's the most common kind of effect that people see? They suddenly get a credit card bill with thousands of dollars that they didn't spend on it or something else?
Well, many times I think the major banks are getting really good at spotting identity theft in action. If you're in New York City and somebody is charging in Paris at the exact same time, you can probably bet that your bank is going to give you a phone call and say, you know, were you making these purchases in Paris on such and such day?
Mm-hmm.
But that's not fail-proof. I think that what's going to happen is that when more people are finding out about the identity theft is, again, when they're trying to transact business on their own, and suddenly they realize that they can't get the mortgage or loan that they need within the time frame that they had hoped to get it because they have to clean up the mess before they can get their credit score.
Until this gets fixed legislatively, Terry, if people suspect that they may be victims of identity theft, what can they do? What should they do?
Tom, I think everybody really needs to just assume that their data is out there. It's gotten to the point now with the disclosures that we're seeing that the problem is a lot bigger than anybody had thought. And I think the best thing for people to do is really pay attention to their credit reports. Come September of this year, every American is going to be entitled to a free copy of their credit report from each of the big three credit reporting agencies, Equifax, Experian, and TransUnion. And I think it's a very good idea for people to start using these free credit reports as sort of their own credit monitoring service. If you stagger when you request these reports through the year, say, you know, in the first 4 months of the year, you take one from one, choose another one a couple of months down the road. You can use it as a sort of mini credit monitoring service. You don't have to pay for somebody else to do it for you. And in this way, you can really keep a good check on what's going on. You want to look at these reports, look for signs of, say, an address change. That's a big red flag. Any kind of credit accounts that you don't recognize. Right away, you want to get in contact with the fraud departments of these credit bureaus and say,
begin to close that line down. Until the legislation comes, watch it yourself. Terry Cullen, personal finance columnist for the Wall Street Journal Online, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
It was my pleasure.
And Gail Hillebrand, senior attorney with Consumers Union in San Francisco, thanks for being with us, Gail.
You're welcome.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR, National Public Radio.